What I wanted to tell you about today is about a series of measurements that have actually gone on for about the last 5 years, looking at basically some high-TC quantum magnets, which have been studied for a long period of time. We were studying them in the context originally of benchmarking the performance of some new time-of-flight inelastic neutron scattering instruments, but along the way, on the basis of very comprehensive data sets that we were able to collect with these with this new instrumentation, I think we're finding some features that haven't been appreciated before. So this is work done by my group at McMaster, which is the top here and at the bottom, and then mostly collaborators from Oak Ridge National Lab. A pretext to everything I'm going to say today is the enormous advances that have been made in neutron scattering during the course of the last, let's call it about 7 or 8 years, and really with the full development of time-of-flight neutron scattering techniques. And these techniques were developed, in fact, on older reactor-based facilities, but they've really come into their own at spallation source facilities. And that's primarily because the spallation source is a neutron source that actually has a timed has a time structure to the production of the neutrons. The neutrons come out in bursts every 60th of a second, as opposed to reactors, which are continuous sources. And so we can take advantage of that time structure. And so this just shows you, it's actually a picture of an older generation time-of-flight instrument, but one for which you could take a picture of it and get something that's meaningful. And basically, you have a train of monochromatic neutron pulses that are coming from the source that's just off screen here and being delivered to your sample, which is sitting in a cryostat over here. And then what we've done is we've wallpapered basically as much of 4 pi steradian around the sample position as we could afford to do with neutron detectors, which are position sensitive and which allow us to time the arrival of the neutrons. So basically, we will time the arrival of the neutrons scattered off of the sample. And of course, the neutrons are massive particles, so they're not all traveling at the speed of light, as would be the case with X-rays. If the neutron scatters inelastically and it transfers a little bit of energy to the sample, then it will slow down. If it gets energy from the sample, then it speeds up. So the time at which it arrives at the neutron detector tells you the energy transfer between the neutron and the sample, and you combine that with the angle of deflection, and you get the momentum transfer. So this is the no neutron left behind approach to neutron scattering. Basically, you try to tag every single neutron that scatters off of the sample with its time of arrival and angle of deflection, and that gives you a comprehensive four-dimensional data set that covers the three momentum dimensions and energy. And basically, you can measure everything, if you like, in a single experiment. So that's the sort of thing that we do, and this is the material that we're going to be doing it on. And of course, Dave Hawthorne has already nicely introduced this whole family of materials. But I'm going to be describing lanthanum cuprate and doped lanthanum cuprate, not in terms of high-temperature superconductivity, although, of course, that's why it is of interest, but rather as a quantum magnet. And that's primarily because with neutrons, we're primarily sensitive to the magnetism in this material. And the magnetism is associated with the layers of copper spin-a-half magnetic moments. The system is actually orthorhombic, as Dave was describing, but we're going to describe it, for the most part, as if it was tetragonal. And of course, so this is the phase diagram that you get if you look at magnetic order parameters only from this system. Actually, the dots that you see, so this is temperature versus X, where X is we're replacing lanthanum 3+ with either strontium 2+ or barium 2+. In either case, of course, it's a different valence state, so you end up removing holes from the system. And the holes that you remove are, or the electrons that you remove, sorry, are from the copper oxide planes. So this type of doping with mobile holes, actually, if you don't have any doping, you have a very strong three-dimensional commensurate antiferromagnet, but that gets killed off very quickly. Only 2% doping of either strontium or barium for lanthanum will kill that off. And then what you're left with is, instead of a three-dimensional commensurate structure, you have a two-dimensional incommensurate structure, which has an onset at much lower temperatures, but that's primarily because of the two-dimensionality rather than anything else. And then that continues until you get to about 5%, and that two-dimensional incommensurate antiferromagnetism actually rotates. Its wave vector rotates. And if you like, the transition temperature for this two-dimensional incommensurate magnetism rises again. Actually, something in this family that has consistently amazed me, and it's known in the field, but people don't make quite as much of it as I think they probably should, is that this this transition from what are referred to as diagonal incommensurate magnetic stripes to parallel incommensurate magnetic stripes occurs at a doping concentration which is coincident with the onset of superconductivity. Okay? And actually, this phase boundary here goes up higher than the corresponding superconducting phase boundary, which only comes up to about 30 Kelvin. But just the same, the onset is at the same concentration. So anyway, so these are the sorts of systems that we're going to be looking at. And just to give you, you know, a cheat sheet in terms of diffraction features, I'll just say that the features that are characteristic of three-dimensional correlations in the case of elastic scattering, you know, three-dimensional long-range order, these appear as spots in our three-dimensional reciprocal space. Okay, whereas if for some reason you have a two-dimensional structure living in your three-dimensional crystal, as you could easily have for this type of layered material, where the layers could easily decouple from each other and form quasi-two-dimensional type magnetic structures, then the signature for that are rods of scattering. If you like, you take your spot in three-dimensional space, there's one dimension, there's one redundant dimension in reciprocal space, and you stretch the scattering out along that redundant dimension, so that gives you a rod of scattering. So rods of scattering are indicative of two-dimensional correlations, and you can keep going with that argument and say that if you had one-dimensional subsystems living in your three-dimensional crystal, you would then get planes of scattering, but that's not going to be relevant for what I'm going to talk about. So I'll just show you what you get in the elastic channel for some of these features, just to kind of set you up for what's coming a bit later. So if I look at this concentration here, which is 1.5% doping, and by the way, we've grown all the crystals that are indicated by the dots here for the lanthanum barium copper oxide system. But for 1.5%, it's kind of an interesting case, because as you cool down, the material first forms a three-dimensional commensurate antiferromagnetic structure, and then if you cool down further, that three-dimensional commensurate antiferromagnetic structure, at least part of it, decomposes into a two-dimensional incommensurate structure. And so these are essentially diffraction patterns. They're maps in reciprocal space. Actually, this is the C-star direction along the y-axis, and this is the direction within the HH direction within the basal plane. So a half corresponds to the pi-pi position. And what you can see as you cool down in these maps is that you gradually see a spot, a three-dimensional Bragg peak, appear at a commensurate position. And as a function of temperature, it first grows, but then when you get down to about 25 Kelvin or so, it then decreases a little bit as you go to lower temperatures. And below 35 Kelvin, you start to see the appearance of this rod of scattering extended along the C star direction or the L direction. And this is the two-dimensional incommensurate magnetism that's coexisting with three-dimensional incommensurate or commensurate order, rather, at this very low temperature. The incommensuration for this two-dimensional scattering is very small at this doping, and so you don't actually see that it is incommensurate in these sorts of measurements, but you will in later measurements. Okay? So that's what happens at very low doping. And I would just say that, as Dave also said, it's been known for 20 years since the pioneering work of John Tranquata's group that the magnetic structure within the tetragonal basal plane, well, it's not tetragonal, but the quasi-tetragonal basal plane, once you start to remove these spins, so dope with holes, is such that the holes organize themselves into these quasi-one-dimensional type structures, which then leave you with finite strips or finite regions of antiferromagnetically correlated spins, which are pi out of phase with respect to each other as you go from one of these magnetic stripes to the next magnetic stripe. And it's the fact that they're pi out of phase with respect to each other, so this would have gone down, up, down, up, down, but it actually went down, up, down, blank, up. Okay, so there's a pi phase shift there, and that's what gives you the incommensuration, and you can see that incommensuration. This is, again, elastic, but higher resolution elastic neutron scattering around the pi-pi point, and in this case, you can see that type of incommensuration. So as you add more holes, that incommensuration grows, which basically means that you're pushing the pushing the charge stripes or the holes, the quasi one dimensional structures closer together, and thereby changing the periodicity of the incommensurate structure. Okay. So this is what our very new data looks like. Yes. Yep. Yeah, so that's a good question. So is it known that it's actually collinear as I've drawn it, or spiral and such? And it's not that easy to sort out, actually. It's the devil is in the details of, you have to model polarized scattering experiments. And there is a better description of the stripe model than with more complicated incommensurate structures. And so the consensus is that this is the correct structure. This is also the structure that would have the charge features associated with it. So basically, as I guess Dave was describing, you get incommensurate magnetic Bragg peaks due to the fact that this domain is pi out of phase with this domain, but you also get incommensurate charge Bragg peaks due to the fact that there's an incommensurate periodicity between these rivers of charge, right? So the charge Bragg peaks and the magnetic Bragg peaks go hand in hand, and that's not the case with a spiral structure. Or, yeah, it's strongly reduced, right, because they're spin a half degrees of freedom. That's right, yep. Yeah, so we'll come to that, actually. We'll come to that. And I'll just jump to the answer, and I'll tell you that that the spectral weight, the total magnetic spectral weight, if you add up all the inelastic scattering and the elastic scattering together as a function of doping, is actually not very, it's rather slowly evolving as a function of doping, at least to the doping levels that we've studied, which is out to the 1/8 doping. But you'll see that a little bit better later on. So this is the first of our really new data sets, which, so I'm now showing you scattering from a sample which is a little bit simpler to describe because it's out at doping of 3.5%. So there's no longer any commensurate magnetic structure. It's just this incommensurate two-dimensional structure that you get below about 25 degrees or so. And this data, and in fact all the data from here on that I'm going to show you, is from one of these four-dimensional metadata sets. So to get the data into a form that we can view it on, a form like this with a two-dimensional contour map, we have to have done two integrations already to get to this point. Otherwise, you can't look at the data. So so I'm looking at maps in the quasi-tetragonal basal plane. So this is HK, and then these are constant energy slices as we go through there. And the sorts of features that I'd like to draw your attention to are the origin of reciprocal space is in the middle of this square, these four points here. These are the two-dimensional magnetic zone centers. These are all pi-pi positions. So this is relatively strong inelastic scattering at the pi-pi positions. And then as we go out along this direction, we're going out to higher wave vectors. And so the scattering at small q is dominated by magnetism. The scattering at large q is dominated by phonon scattering. And so the next thing that I'm going to show you is another two-dimensional projection of the same meta data set. But now I'm going to show you the x-axis will be a cut along this particular direction in reciprocal space, which goes through one of these pi-pi positions, but then the next magnetic zone center out will be something like a half, three halves, okay? And then it'll go out even further. Okay, so that's this here. So I'm showing you energy as a function of that particular direction in reciprocal space. So this goes through the half minus a half pi-pi position. So that's one of the pi-pi positions. And so there's a two-dimensional magnetic zone center here, and you see these very dispersive magnetic excitations going straight up. Actually, these would go up to about 200 millivolts at this sort of doping. And then you go out further in Q, and the next magnetic zone center you come to is minus a half, three halves. You see sort of the same thing, but phonons are creeping in. And then as you go further out, you get the phonons stronger and stronger and stronger. Okay. Yeah. I'm not showing you the Bragg spots are there, but I'm not showing you the Bragg spots basically because of the intensity scale that I've chosen. Okay, so the Bragg intensity is all down here at zero energy, right? So I'd have to show you the data on a different intensity scale to show you that. But something that you can see right here actually is that there's interesting structure, and that's going to be the focus of this talk. There's interesting structure to the spectral weight of the magnetic scattering as a function of energy. And the bottom line will be that that structure actually correlates strongly with the crossings of this very dispersive spin excitation with rather dispersion-free phonon excitations, which are almost flat. They're almost going across here. But you can see a lot of structure, actually. You can see acoustic-like phonons going up and down here, which get weaker as you go towards Q equals zero. And then the first of the optic phonon modes is around here at about 19 MeV. And you can see those get very strong, actually, as you go out to some of these zone centers. So I should mention that this structure in the energy dependence, which you can see here, which I'm going to show you again later, as a function of energy around 20 MeV, was previously reported on these two dopings of strontium-doped 214. This is from Steve Hayden's group from somewhere between about 6 and 8 years ago on LSCO, which is almost optimally doped, and then on LSCO, which is underdoped. And in both cases, this group reported a rather large enhancement of what they interpreted as the magnetic cross-section, just below 20 MeV in both cases. And in fact, they attributed this and its temperature dependence to strictly magnetic scattering interacting with the superconductivity in this system that develops at lower temperatures. But the thing to note here is that we're observing rather similar enhancements in what you might think of as the purely magnetic scattering for a sample that isn't superconducting at all. Okay. Yes. Because it's so dispersive, right? So because J is huge, right? So it does have to loop back. So it goes straight up to 200 MeV, which is somewhere up here, and then the zone boundary would be somewhat up here, and then it would come back down. It's very steep. Yeah. So, it really is 200 MeV, and the top of the band that I'm showing you is 40 MeV, right? So it goes up a factor of five higher. It's into the next whatever is above us, which I don't think there is anything above us. But anyway, so that's why it's so dispersive. So these sorts of features were observed before, but the way they were doing these experiments before is that we're focusing on wave vectors around the pi-pi position only, so they didn't get... because of the nature of the instruments they were using, they didn't get this full perspective on the scattering to see where these enhancements might be coming from. Okay, so yet another one of these projections. So now I'm showing you basically in one of these one direction in the quasi-tetragonal basal plane as a function of L. And again, I'm showing you the data in energy slices. And what I wanted to point out here was that even this inelastic scattering, you can see these real telltale signatures of really pretty strictly two-dimensional magnetic scattering down at relatively low energies. So this is the half-half magnetic zone center, and this is half three-halves here. And you can see these rod-like features. And as you get up towards the crossing with the optic phonons, which occurs 16, 18, and 20 MeV, this scattering becomes much stronger. And you can see these rods of scattering actually going out to much higher wave vectors. So this is actually telling us that we've got this confluence of the two-dimensional spin excitations and lattice excitations or phonons that are also pretty two-dimensional because we're seeing them out at very large Q. And you see the strong enhancement, as I say, between 16 and about 20 MeV, and then it dies off again. Okay. So this is what this looks like as a function of temperature. So this would be one of the half-half magnetic zone centers, and this would be a half three-half magnetic zone center. And then we're going from 7 Kelvin to 100 Kelvin to 300 Kelvin. So you see the same sorts of features in all of them. Of course, the intensities are changing. And we're interested in backing out the intrinsic temperature dependence, if you like, of the spin excitations. So the function that we're measuring, the dynamic structure factor, which we typically call S of Q and omega, it's actually the product of two functions, which we need to keep track of if we want to understand temperature dependence. It goes like chi double prime of Q and omega. And chi double prime of Q and omega, that's the imaginary part of the dynamic susceptibility or the energy absorbing part of the dynamic susceptibility. So this contains, chi double prime contains all the physics of the system that we're interested in. But there's another term which has, in a certain sense, a trivial temperature dependence to it, which is the Bose factor, which also has physics to it, but it's the physics of detailed balance as opposed to the physics of the system that we're interested in. In any case, there's an analytic form for that term, and knowing that and having a handle on our background, we can actually subtract off these two, and we can integrate along the energy dependence of, we can integrate in Q to capture all the magnetic scattering around the pi-pi position, and we can look at the energy dependence of the scattering and the energy dependence of the chi double prime. And so that's what you see here. This is the energy dependence of the scattering itself at the pi-pi position at those three temperatures. And then here we've isolated chi double prime. This integral is an integral in Q, just to make sure we capture all the magnetic scattering. And you can see that it's really quite structured. So at both 7 Kelvin and 100 Kelvin, this integral of chi double prime is actually very flat, out to about 20 MeV, and then we see two peaks, which are associated with two crossings of the spin excitations with the optic phonons, and then a rather fast fall off, and then another confluence of the magnetic excitations with the optic phonons, and then in the bottom, you just see, where the spectral weight has moved as a function of temperature, and what you can see is that relative to 300 Kelvin, the spectral weight, basically above 22 or 23 MeV, the spectral weight of chi double prime is actually identical at 300 Kelvin, 100 Kelvin, and 7 Kelvin, and the buildup in spectral weight that you get as you cool down is all below this onset of what's essentially the lowest optic phonons. It's all at about 20 MeV. Okay, so quite an interesting and odd spectral weight. So then when we look at our neutron scattering data, of course we can. We can read off the energies of the relevant optic phonons. So we can read off the eigenvalues of the optic phonons, but that doesn't tell us the eigenvectors that are involved for those optic phonons. And in particular, we'd be interested in knowing, what's the significance of the optic phonons that correspond to these enhancements here, because that seems to be where all the action is happening, and especially this one here at 19 MeV. And so to get at that, we have to team up with theory colleagues who can use techniques like DFT to actually calculate the phonon spectra, and then on the basis of the comparison between the intensities of the phonon spectra and the eigenvalues and what we measure, we can use that to try to understand the eigenvectors of the phonons that are involved. And so this shows a summary of some of these DFT calculations. This is actually looking at SFQ and omega as calculated by DFT at a magnetic zone center. So this is one of the half-half L positions. And you're seeing the inelastic scattering due to phonons only, so there's no magnetism here. And you can see that there are these features right here that come in around 19 MeV that have very little dispersion. So they're very flat as a function of L, which means they're very quasi-two-dimensional. And there's actually one at about 19 MeV, and then there are several that are just below it. Okay, and the one at 19 MeV, the eigenvector that corresponds to that is illustrated here. And it's actually this very interesting sort of breathing mode of the oxygens, and it's primarily, the displacements involved are primarily only due to the oxygens in the copper oxide quasi-tetragonal plane. And it's a breathing mode such that it's a pi-pi breathing mode such that the oxygens, all come in together around the center of one of these squares and then go out away from it and in and out in this pi-pi-like fashion. Okay, so this eigenvector we can identify in a rather robust way by comparing our neutron results with the DFT calculation. And this eigenvector is actually quite interesting because the displacements that are involved are almost all oxygen displacements. They're almost only due to the oxygens that are in the copper oxide planes. So there's another plane, so it's copper oxide, lanthanum oxide, copper oxides. The oxygen in the lanthanum oxide planes are more or less not involved, and the displacements are within that quasi-tetragonal plane. Okay. So that makes this phonon actually very two-dimensional because it skips a layer of oxygens, if you like, as you go along the C direction. And in addition, I just want to remind myself of where I was going. In addition, there's at least two things that are very interesting about this eigenvector. One thing is that we know that the holes in the copper oxide planes actually reside on the oxygens, not on the copper. So the holes, as we dope, are on the oxygens that are involved in the displacements. And in addition, we know that there are what is referred to as good enough Kanamori rules, which are a phenomenological description of magnetic exchange in solids. And we know that from this work that the strength of the exchange and even the sign of the exchange is very sensitive to the precise bond orientation that are involved in these super exchange paths. So for example, a so-called 180-degree exchange path, as you see here, gives you antiferromagnetic interactions and strong interactions, whereas a 90-degree interaction, as you would see here, gives you ferromagnetic and weak interactions. So if the nature of this eigenvector is that the oxygen that's in the middle of this bond is fluctuating back and forth, you would expect that to couple very strongly to the magnetism because it's going to affect the magnetic super exchange path in about as strong a way as possible. Okay. So here I'll just show you the doping dependence. So I was showing you our measurements at 3.5% doping. We've actually measured out to close to the 1/8 doping, and we've measured in both the LSCO and the LBCO samples. You can see, you know, so now you can see the incommensuration grow as you dope. You've basically got a spectral weight that goes straight up from the magnetic zone center for all dopings in both LSCO and LBCO. We actually can't tell LBCO and LSCO apart in this regard. But you can see that you eventually end up with rather distinct rods. So you can see two rods in this projection going straight up. And you can see that these are cuts at constant energy in different samples. And when you get out to the samples that have large doping, I don't know how well you can see this, but I can see four incommensurate features around each of the pi-pi positions. So you know, that's all the way we expect it to be, but these enhancements of the spectral weight as you go up as a function of energy, you know, occurring at the crossings of the phonons with the spin excitations occurs at all concentrations, including the undoped sample. So this is a generic feature of this entire family, which makes a lot of sense, actually, you know, because you know, the phonons don't change very much, and the spin excitations, the spectral weight of the spin excitations is not changing very much. So I just say this is just making that argument quantitative. Again, if we isolate chi double prime, I'm showing it here for four different samples going from a non-superconducting ground state to superconducting ground states, and we can overlay the energy dependence of this scattering on top of each other very well. I would just say that really the only difference that you see in these spectra from the superconducting samples really all look identical. The non-superconducting sample has enhanced magnetic spectral weight below about 12 to 15. MEV, which is not so surprising. You might think of this in terms of a spin gap, but what's interesting is that we see this excess intensity at low energies not as a function of temperature, so it's not as if the superconductivity kills off the spectral weight as we go down in temperature, but the superconductivity does seem to kill off the spectral weight as you go across in concentration. So the low energy suppression of chi double prime seems to occur as a function of doping, but not as a function of temperature, at least for the temperatures that we've studied. Okay, and with that, I apologize for running over, and I'd just like to thank my collaborators. This work was Jared Wagman's PhD thesis, so thank you.
I'm very excited by the eigenvector of this 19 MeV.
Right.
Because it reminds me of possibility of Plaquet resonance.
Yep.
Because in one of our early work, we suggested that So in that sense, the coupling of the phonon used to some low energy Plaquet resonance. I'll have to think about it. It's very fascinating.
Yeah, that's right. No, I think actually the 19 MeV phonon eigenvector is relatively easy to identify. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different phonons, right, as a mm-hmm. function of temperature, and some of the, at least a subset of the others are harder to identify, to uniquely identify. But this one's rather robust, actually.
Because it fits nicely with the resonating singlet bonds on a square.
Yeah. I mean, I was really, this is the way I had been thinking of it. I was wondering, you know, why should the magnetism care, right? And I think the magnetism should care about this, actually.
Is this related to things like the 41 MeV resonance in other materials at higher doping?
Right.
And also the kinks and ARPEZ and things like that?
No, I don't think it is, actually. Okay. So this here, so these earlier studies on higher doped LSCO, they see, you know, so this higher energy feature is essentially the 41 MeV feature, right? And, you know, so our focus was not at these high energies, but I'm convinced that we would have seen what they saw at these higher energies. So it's this feature here and these features, well, here for lower dopings that we're seeing. But separately, there is the 41 MeV feature. Now, the 41 MeV feature, my take on it, what was I trying to show? No, I'm going. So, I know what I was trying to do. Yeah. My apologies. This one. Okay. So, you know, basically where you can see the incommensuration, the excitations start off at these incommensurate zone centers. So they start off at distinct positions around the pi-pi position, and the 41 MeV resonance is basically where they all come together again, right? So in all of our analysis, we're trying our best to integrate in Q such that we capture all of that scattering as we go out. So we, in fact, wouldn't see we wouldn't see really a resonance enhancement there, because I don't think there is appreciable difference in the integrated intensity as you go up there. But it's due to the so-called hourglass dispersion. And this would be a cut across the hourglass for a system that has, you know, four such incommensurate peaks. And the four peaks are due to the fact that that all the crystals are twinned. Yep. Right. Yeah, it's not so bad, actually. So the phonons, you can more or less disentangle. Most of the spectral weight due to the phonons is out at much higher Qs. So, for example, here, you know, we're at these are two different pi-pi positions, right? So to see the phonons, and you can see the phonons, right? You can see them here. But to see them really strongly, you would need to go out to much higher Q. And there is part of this data set which I'm not showing, which is at much higher Q. But you see, the integrated spectral weight of all of these data sets, the magnetic, aren't that different. Right? They're not that different. So you are losing magnetic spectral weight, integrated magnetic spectral weight, as you dope, because you're pulling out moment. But you're probably only losing it as, you know, linearly in X or something like that. You know, so it's not the case that you know, all the magnetism is down at X equals zero, and as soon as you lose the commensurate magnetism, you know, it's gone. It's not. It's there. It's there all the way along. Yeah. So we haven't done much of that for this system. So for neutron scattering, it's hard to work in magnetic fields greater than about 12 Tesla. The sorts of energy splittings that you expect to see, it's essentially G mu BH. So G is 2 for this system. And so 12 Tesla would correspond to, it's just a little over 1 MeV. So the sorts of fields that we could sensibly apply would affect the very low energy spectrum, but would not appreciably affect the energy spectrum around here. But that would also be interesting to do, especially with a stronger field.